All right, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for giving your time this afternoon to come out to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund's Secret History of Comic Censorship. I'm Charles Brownstein. I'm the Executive Director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and we're a nonprofit organization that protects the freedom to read. And that freedom has been under assault from the very beginnings of comic books in the United States. In fact, it's the same old story every generation, right? The job of younger people is to horrify their elders, and our job as elders is to either have a dialogue with our kids about why we're horrified and why they like it, or to try to ban it, try to take it away. And you see it right now with the great debate raging about video games. Well, we need to take it away because people are being violent, and these violent people play video games, therefore it's the video games' fault. That bogus argument goes all the way back into the origins of comic books. And unlike video games, which today have a very powerful group standing up for their rights, comics was not so lucky, and comics was severely scarred by moral panic that led to censorship. And so today, it is a great privilege to be able to be joined by Dr. Carol Tilley, a professor at the University of Illinois, and Charles Kochman, the executive editor at Abrams Comic Arts, who is an expert on the topic and has published a book that we will be offering to those that join the fund afterwards. We have The Horror of the Horror, so the first two people to join after the panel can get a copy of that. But right now, let's look into the history and the moral panic that defined comics for more than a generation and find out what it means today. So can we please have a warm round of applause for Dr. Carol Tilley?
Great. It's wonderful to be here with an unhappy microphone. Let's try that. So can everyone hear okay? All right, perfect. I normally do a little bit more freeform presentations, but I've got some great letters to read today, and so I'm going to be using notes. But I think you're going to have a great time. Not quite 60 years ago, and just about 15 miles from where we're hanging out this afternoon, a young man sat down to write a letter. April 23rd, 1954, 284 Madison Avenue, Crestkill, New Jersey. Dear sir, I have read your item, Comic Books, Blueprints for Delinquency, in the current issue of Reader's Digest. I agree with you that crime and horror comics must go, or delinquency will grow. But when you say that all comic books must go, I say you're deadly wrong. I am an 11-year-old boy. I read about a dozen comics every day, and I don't see how you can say that crime comics total four-fifths of all comic books. About a week ago, my father said I couldn't buy any more comics, not because they were making a bad impression on me, but because I bought too many. Anybody that goes out and kills someone because he reads a comic book is a simple-minded idiot. Sounds silly? So does your item. In your item, you gave several examples. I think it's only fair that I gave some. When my Uncle Fred was a boy, he read nothing but detective stories. His mother was sure he would wind up a crook. Did he? I should say not. He wound up as vice president of the Pennsylvania Railroad and retired a rich man. I sincerely wish that you could understand comic books as I do, and I hope that someday in the future, people will know their goods and their evils. Sincerely yours, Brian Arthur McLaughlin. Brian's letter was addressed to Frederick Wortham, whose book Seduction of the Innocent had just been excerpted in Reader's Digest. And I probably don't have to tell any of you who Frederick Wortham was. For anyone interested in 20th century print culture, especially comics and similar forms of child-selected media, Frederick Wortham and his book, Seduction of the Innocent, serve as historical and cultural touchstones. Seduction was a rousing call on the rousing call for limitations on the sale of comics to children based on the author's clinical evidence of the format's detrimental links to juvenile delinquency and children's general welfare. It captured the American public's imagination when it was published in April 1954. Sociologist C. Wright Mills, writing in the New York Times, called it, quote, a most commendable use of the professional mind in the service of the public. Wortham was respected, if temperamental. He was a psychiatrist who was active in the U.S. from the 1920s through the 1970s. He made his mark as a forensic psychiatrist studying people such as the cannibalistic serial killer Albert Fish. In the 1940s, his interest broadened to include juvenile delinquency and race relations. He co-founded a clinic, the Lafarge Clinic, in Harlem, where he and his integrated staff of volunteers treated African Americans, including many children who were then denied treatment at other medical facilities in the city. It operated in the basement of St. Philip's Episcopal Church at the corner of 134th and 7th Avenue. Some of his patients there called him Dr. Quarter, because that's how much Wortham charged for an appointment. For many years, he also directed a clinic at Bellevue Hospital, where he treated many kids who were there at the direction of the city's juvenile justice system. These juvenile delinquents were simply troubled kids who didn't like school, daydreamed too much, or had learning disabilities. Some were physically, mentally, or sexually abused. A few of these kids were petty criminals or had been diagnosed with psychotic conditions. But because almost all of them read comics, Wortham argued that comics and juvenile delinquency went hand in hand. Beginning in the late 1940s, Wortham and his message were everywhere, including numerous popular and professional magazine articles, radio programs, and public lectures. The public listened. When Seduction of the Innocent was published, it sold more than 16,000 copies in the U.S. in its first 6 months, which is more than it might sound like today. In April 1954, a few days after his book was published, Wortham was the star witness at the U.S. Senate's Judiciary Committee subcommittee hearings on juvenile delinquency, held here in New York City at the U.S. District Court in Lower Manhattan. The following letter was written the day after Wortham testified before the Senate subcommittee. April 22, 1954. Dear Mr. Wortham, we have just finished reading your recent article, which appeared in the May issue of the Reader's Digest. We thought that perhaps you would want our honest opinion as experienced readers of this trashy literature. At the risk of hurting your feelings and putting ourselves open to criticism, we have decided on this wording. It stinks. You seem to have the opinion that nowhere except in the comic books can you find the degrading influence of which you speak. Well, in case you've not read as many of the classics as you speak of, we would like to enlighten you on the matter. We've read some of the great stories of the world, Shakespeare's tales, Grimm's tales, and other great writers that would curdle your blood, and that not even the worst of the horror tales and comics could hope to stand up to. In fact, we think that you will find some of the stories in the comics known as Tales of the Crypt, Vault of Horror, and others come from ideas taken from some of these great classics. We don't sincerely believe your article will hinder the sale of comic books, because it seems to be the case that more comic books are sold than the Reader's Digest could hope to. Yours truly, Tommy Tudor, Clarence Flynn, Gene Walker, seniors, Wilson High School, Wilson, Oklahoma. In the early 1940s, superhero titles dominated the comics marketplace. Some literary and cultural critics, such as Sterling North and Stanley Kunitz, objected to superhero themes because of their perceived violent and fascist elements. And these are real quotes, too, what they had to say about comics. But because many superheroes contributed to the war effort through their storylines, and because most adults were preoccupied with the ongoing conflict, these objections never attained a critical mass. Superhero titles continued to be published following the end of the war, but publishers also introduced new genres such as romance, jungle, horror, and true crime, which flourished. In part, publishers intended these new genres to capture the reading interests of more mature readers, especially veterans and other young adults who were weaned on superhero comics but now wanted something more substantive. The publishers intended these newer genres for a non-child audience failed to keep young readers from devouring them, especially those with deliciously provocative titles such as Untamed Love, Forbidden Worlds, and Shocking Mystery. And young people did indeed devour comics. More than 95% of school-aged kids, boys, girls, white, black, brown, rich, and poor, read comics regularly. More than 80% of high school-aged teens did the same. By the time Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent was published and the Senate was undertaking its hearings, there were nearly 1 billion new comics issues sold annually in the U.S. alone. That's the equivalent of about 30 new comics issues for each person who was then alive in the U.S. Bowing to public and governmental pressure, comics publishers created the Comics Magazine Association of America, the CMAA, in the fall of 1954. That body soon implemented a restrictive editorial code. Aimed at staving off government intervention in the industry, the CMAA's code crippled the successful comics industry by ensuring comics which carried its imprimatur were free of offensive content such as poor grammar, excessive violence, disobedient children, and supernatural beings like vampires and zombies. The code persisted, with modifications, until January 2011. So the story of comics' rise to success through the 1940s and 50s is well known, and books like David Haydu's 10-Cent Plague and Amy Nyberg's Seal of Approval do a good job of outlining the general discontent. But they don't tell the whole story, and that's part of what I want to share with you today. How did Wortham end up being a star witness for the Senate? What unusual alliances were considered? Who among the comics world told stories out of school? And how did young comics fans try to save their comics from government censorship? Wortham's first rant about comics, and yes, it really was a rant, came in December 1947 when he was testifying in Washington before a post office commission. He was there to defend the publisher of a nudist magazine against charges of obscenity. He spent 3 hours in the witness chair, and Wortham argued that nudity was much less reprehensible than almost anything he had seen in comics. As Judith Crist, who was then a writer for the New York Herald Tribune, stated in her article about Wortham's testimony, quote, "Thumbing through his pile of comic books, Dr. Wortham pointed to one illustration after another. The reader gets the impression that all women are young and pretty and have accentuated breasts," he said. "At all times and all locales, they run around barefoot in brassieres and panties. It's obvious to the simplest GI, let alone to psychiatrists," he added parenthetically, "that a half-dressed woman is far more enticing than one without clothes." Judith Crist, who died this past year, went on to a long, respected career as a film critic. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, however, she was a young reporter just beginning. And along the way, she became one of Frederick Wortham's confidants and allies. A couple of slides ago, I showed you her article about Wortham in the March 1948 Collier's Magazine, Horror in the Nursery, with the kid who was stabbing the other one with a ballpoint pen. That article was really critical to bringing Wortham's concerns about comics to a national audience. That national attention, coupled with a growing number of attempts to legislate the sale of comics, dozens of comics burnings, and numerous anti-comic speeches, compelled magazine publishers, comics publishers, in late 1948 to create the Association of Comics Magazine Publishers and devise an editorial code. This organization had little authority, and one of the biggest publishers, DC National, didn't even join, preferring to stick with its own in-house editorial policies and advisors. Still, there were bitter feelings directed at Wortham and his colleagues. For instance, in September 1948, Hilda Mosse, which is how we say her name in the Midwest, who was a psychiatrist working alongside Wortham at the Lafarge Clinic, appeared with Gus Edson, who created the Gumps, and Mort Weisinger, who was then editor of Superman, and they appeared together on a radio program on WEVD here in New York. According to an account by Mosse, Weisinger verbally attacked her and Wortham. Quote, "He said he was surprised that after reading so many comic books, that they had not affected us, so that we had gotten ourselves into jail, and maybe we were both out on bail now. He painted a bad picture as to what would happen if they'd make me a commissar for comic books." Throughout late 1947 and 1948, Wortham began compiling massive amounts of intelligence about the comics industry. Much of his early understanding was shaped by information funneled to him by Gershon Legman, a self-described folklorist and publisher who was primarily interested with two things, humor and sex. Legman fed Wortham's appetite for inside information, sending him lists of crime comics, explaining how comics changed titles but retained issue numbering, and outlining suspicious business connections, such as companies that also owned paper mills. But he also shared reports on New York University professor Harvey Zorba's workshops on comics. Zorba was an early advocate for comics in education, and he hosted several workshops at NYU in the 1940s focused on using comics to support learning. Legman wrote to Wortham in December 1947 saying, "I wonder if you know of the fake seminar being run by Harvey Zorba, presumably an examination of the comics. Of the first 17 speakers, 15 were paid agents of the comic book companies themselves. Why don't you drop in and break up the party with a few facts?" This germ of an idea, that there were paid apologists for comics, planted by Legman in this letter, took hold of Wortham. He began seeking even more information about people employed in the advisory capacity by DC National Comics, Fawcett, Hillman, and more. Over time, his ire focused on DC National and its slate of advisors, including Loretta Binder and Josette Frank. Binder, who's on the right, was a psychiatrist at Bellevue, where Wortham also worked. He was, as I said, a temperamental, imperious sort, and as much as anything, he may have held a grudge against Binder from the start, even before her association with DC, because of a possible disagreement he had with her late husband, Paul Schilder, who was another psychiatrist with whom he worked. Josette Frank is really more interesting to me here. She began working as an advisor to DC National All-American Comics in 1940, first providing guidance on the Tom Mix and Superman radio shows, and then as part of the company's editorial advisory committee. She wrote book reviews, reviewed scripts, and advised the editors on everything from advertisements to lettering. She seemed to have a good relation, especially with Max Gaines, and her involvement with the company diminished after he sold his interests. Her day job, however, was with the Child Study Association, a parents' guidance organization where she served as a consultant on children's books, radios, movies, television. Her longtime boss there, Sidonie Grunberg, was for a while employed by Fawcett Comics as an editorial advisor as well. Frank was an earnest, career-minded woman, widowed and with children of her own, who had been involved in progressive causes since she was a young woman. She wasn't immediately excited about the offer to work with DC National, but she ultimately worked with the company for nearly 15 years. Despite the fact that her name and affiliation with the Child Study Association appeared on the masthead of every issue of DC Comics beginning in 1941, Frank and the Child Study Association became Wortham's favorite targets. He accused the organization of hiding its ties to comics and of being a shill for corrupt publishers. At one point, he even took extensive notes when one of his friends described going to a party held in Frank's honor. His friend reported that Josette looked, quote, insignificant, simple, and sloppy, while Loretta Binder, who was serving tea at the party, his friend said, looked like a witch. Wortham let anyone who would listen know what he thought about Josette Frank and the Child Study Association. So it's not much of a surprise when Ellen Wales Walpole, an erstwhile children's author who had become a confidant of Senator Estes Kefauver, contacted Wortham in early 1950. Walpole, it seems, may have had some mental health issues, according to a mutual friend, but she definitely had a grudge with the Child Study Association. It seems that in the late 1940s, Sidonie Grunberg had said harsh words about a series of books Walpole was proposing on children's emotions. I'm still uncovering the pieces of the story, but Walpole appears to have funneled her anger against the Child Study Association into a form of revenge. It was Walpole, you see, who reached out to Wortham and arranged for Wortham and Senator Kefauver to meet. Walpole continued to work with Wortham throughout 1950, encouraging him to develop questions that Kefauver's Committee on Organized Crime could ask comics publishers and consultants. Although Wortham was unhappy with the results of the 1950 investigation that Kefauver led, he willingly testified in 1954 when the issue of comics returned to the Senate's and Kefauver's purview. So were it not for a negative review of a children's book, it's possible that Kefauver and Wortham may never have met. As Wortham increasingly became the voice of the anti-comics movement, he heard from some surprising individuals, comics creators. Some of them, like Malcolm Kildell and Morris Weiss, were respectable, if not big-name, comics folks. Kildell worked on a variety of titles, including Classics Illustrated, and he created Speed Centaur, you can see on the left, and Sergeant Spook. Weiss did work for Timely Comics, the forerunner to Marvel, creating their popular teenage character, Margie. Kildell wrote to Wortham in 1950, complaining about the ACMP's lax editorial code, which he deemed, quote, a farce, because the industry was regulating itself. Quote, I dislike censorship as much as anyone, but I believe the comic book field needs a policing, similar perhaps to the baseball world. Comics needs a Landis, referring to baseball's first commissioner. Weiss, who spoke to Wortham in the late 1940s, told the psychiatrist that comics publishers wanted blood and that he agreed that crime comics were bad. Ham Fisher, who created Joe Palooka, even tried to draw Wortham, and for that matter, the U.S. Senate, into his long-running feud with Al Capp. Fisher told Wortham that he would be unwelcome in the halls of the National Cartoonist Society, which is funny because I don't think the society had physical halls, but that doesn't matter. Most important, though, among the handful of comics creators who reached out to Frederick Wortham is Jerry Siegel, Superman's co-creator. During the early 1950s, Siegel sent form letters to plenty of folks, including, as Brad Rica recently documented in his book Superboys, J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI. But he also sent two letters to Wortham. Wortham, in fact, wanted to reproduce portions of Siegel's letters in Seduction of the Innocent, but attorneys for his publisher, Reinhardt, intervened. Seduction does include a bit about Siegel and some of what Kildell, Fisher, and Weiss shared with Wortham, although it's all unattributed. So it's April 1954. Seduction of the Innocent is released, and despite his disapproval of the result of the 1950s hearings, Wortham testifies at the new hearings about the relationship between comics and juvenile delinquency. He joined more than a dozen other witnesses, including Helen Meyer, vice president of Dell Publications, Walt Kelly, the creator of the Pogo comic strip, and president of the National Cartoonist Society, and William Gaines, publisher of EC Comics. According to the background research gathered by Senate investigators, Wortham's testimony represented what they called the extreme conservative position among the psychiatrists who were to speak at the hearings. Both Wortham's and Bill Gaines' testimony at these hearings are well remembered among comics nerds and geeks like us. What's less well remembered is that through a series of editorials, Gaines invited EC's readers to share their views on comics with the Senate committee. And I should point out, too, you may not be able to read the caption, but the picture on the right that's badly reproduced is from a couple of years after the Senate hearings, and that's Estes Gefalver and his children, and they're all reading comics. I just love that photo. In late 1954, one of EC's readers, Harley Elliott of Salina, Kansas, wrote to the Senate subcommittee to explain why he read comics. He said, I'm 13 years of age and a normal American boy. I read comics every day and also collect them. Many war comics have historical stories in them. Thus, I learn more about the world. Science fiction stories boost my dreams for the future. Horror stories increase my imagination. Humorous comics make me forget my worries and troubles. Elliot spoke to me last year. He still lives in Salina. He grew up to be a published poet, a novelist, and an artist. And he said to me last year that he learned more history from Bill Gaines' EC Comics than he ever did in school. About 200 readers, many of them young people, wrote to the Senate subcommittee. And here's part of another letter. Dear sirs, I'm disgusted with your ridiculous claims about comics. I assure you that I am not and do not want to be a juvenile delinquent. We don't buy these mags because we have a thirst for blood. We buy them for the stories, the snap endings, the artwork, and because they deal with the unknown. That letter was written by then 14-year-old Philip Proctor. His disappointment in what public outcry, the Senate hearings, and the Comics Code did to his beloved comics helped propel him to a career as a satirist. He co-founded the Fire Sign Theater, and if you don't know that group, they're kind of like America's Monty Python of the radio. As Proctor recounted to me in a recent interview, he said he wanted to spend his life ridiculing, quote, the blue-nosed, tight-assed censors, end quote, like the ones who crippled the comics industry. Wortham also continued to receive sporadic letters from young readers. This is from May 1954. Dear Dr. Wortham, I'm 13 years old and I read comics. My opinion probably doesn't mean a thing to you because I'm only a child, but I just had to let you know my views. In your article, you claim that comic books, horror, sex, love, crime, increase delinquency. I disagree. I believe those children you spoke of were delinquent before they even saw a comic book. I have at least 25 friends who read the same kinds of comics as I do, and of which you speak in your article. I sincerely believe we are all of sound mind. What percent of all children reading comics go around killing people? Do you approve of smoking? Does not that injure you more than our comic books? Do you suggest that all children give up comic books and turn now to cigarettes, adult crime, and sex books and liquor? If we did, wouldn't we have a fine U.S. in a few years? I want you to understand that I'm not trying to be rude, but just expressing my views on the subject. I would like very much to know your opinion on the subject and will await eagerly your reply. Sincerely, Lynn Crawford. There's no record that Wortham replied to Ms. Crawford. I've spent a great deal of time reading through his archival materials the past few years, and he rarely responded to anyone who challenged or disagreed with him. What you might be able to see, though, on the scan is that he redlined it, red-penciled it, marking up her spelling and grammar errors. He enjoyed doing that. For the most part, the Senate didn't respond to letter writers either. Some writers received generic thank you notes or thank you for your comment postcards, but that seems to have been unusual. For instance, Brian Mulholland, who was 15 when he wrote to the Senate in 1954, told me last year that I was the first person to ever acknowledge that letter. And here's what he wrote. To whom it may concern, I have, for the past few months, been urged by the editors of EC Comics to write to you about the recent comic book investigation. I had failed to do so because I thought it absurd that the U.S. government would or could abolish harmless literature. But just yesterday, I read that EC Comics is being forced to drop 5 of its publications because wholesalers and retailers throughout the country have been intimidated into refusing to handle crime and horror-type comic books. That's the type of thing that goes on in Russia, but not in America. Of course, I realized that the reason for the stopping of this type of literature is to prevent juvenile delinquency. I have a collection of 85 ECs, which are supposed to be detrimental to the morals of American youth, and yet I am as honest and as clean as you would want your own son to be. I am speaking for the majority, the comic book readers, as opposed to the minority who have been so successful, the few disturbed parents. When I found Mulholland last year, he had recently retired as a district attorney. More than half a century after writing this letter, he said, I was surprised at the maturity of thought and expression. I don't know if I could have done a better job now. The Senate subcommittee never acted on comics except to issue a report of the hearings. The CMAA's comics code seemed to placate many people who were concerned about comics, although Wortham was skeptical of the whole endeavor. He wasn't alone. Lyle Stewart, who you see on the left, publisher of the Scandal Sheet Exposé and general gad about the EC offices, seemed to have approached Wortham on behalf of Bill Gaines, or maybe just on behalf of himself, about becoming the czar for the comics code. Exactly what he proposed is probably lost to history. But Stewart, though, did send Wortham a comic in 1954 that bore the new CMAA seal of approval. And here's part of what he wrote about it. Judge Murphy, as you may aware, that's Charles Murphy on the right, the first comic czar, is a not very bright political hack who was selected mostly because of his religious faith. Not too surprisingly, his code reads like a church code approved by Cardinal Spellman, and that avoids things that were rarely complained about in comics. Bill Gaines, who, for all his faults, has played it straight and in good faith at all times, now will be the victim of his own honesty. That wasn't Wortham's last contact with EC. In January 1955, Al Feldstein wrote to Wortham's wife, Hesketh, after having spoken with her on the telephone. Feldstein appears to have initiated both conversations. Now, Feldstein, according to an interview that was published a few years ago, has no recollection of ever having contacted Hesketh, but from what I can tell, this looks like his signature. The letter shows his frustration with the implementation of the CMAA's code, but the penciled notes indicate, quote, Dr. Wortham can't give you a statement for this purpose in any case. He doesn't think the whole Murphy, the CMAA, setup legitimate, end quote. The code led the way to fewer comics publishers, fewer comics titles, and fewer comics readers, especially fewer kids reading comics. And of course, it also arguably helped pave the way for the underground comics movement of the 60s and 70s. And that, in turn, helped spark the more contemporary alternative and indie comics movement. I'm looking for a silver lining, really. The eminent cartoonist Carl Barks had a slightly different take, though. Writing to a fan in the late 1970s, Barks said, quote, although much glory was heaped upon the quality of the Gaines output, I am inclined to believe that the infamous book by Dr. Wortham was all that saved comics from total destruction at the hands of the tasteless publishers of senseless gore. I know that many people argue that what children and grown-ups read does not influence their behavior. I wonder if those people ever heard of a book called the Bible, or another called the Quran. Wortham died in 1981, and his papers soon afterwards made their way to the Library of Congress. Until 2010, however, they were unavailable to the public because of his executor's wishes. I've now spent quite a bit of time there examining a portion of the extensive more than 200 boxes worth of his materials. One result of my work is that I've been able to document that he made up and misconstrued some of his evidence against comics. Lots of people have long questioned his sensationalized rhetoric, logical inconsistencies, and lack of documentation. Should be enough to damn him right there. But I discovered that he asked kids leading questions, sometimes knitted together their quotes in misleading ways, omitted relevant details about his young patients' lives in ways that might affect readers' understanding, and much, much more. And just to give you a quick sense of what the kinds of changes I found, the kinds of manipulation. This is a quote. You see the total quote here. The blue text appeared in the original case note transcript, and it was omitted from the final version in Seduction of the Innocent. The red text, or the orange text, was included in Seduction of the Innocent, but was never in the original. That is, Wortham just made it up. And then there are the strike-throughs, which are just words that were omitted altogether. So you'll notice, for instance, that the boy says that his favorite comics are the war comics. But this quote that Wortham used appeared in his chapter about Batman and Robin and homosexuality. And so war comics didn't really suit Wortham's point there. So we have a young boy who actually was seeing Wortham because he had sodomized another child, which Wortham does tell us, but he also admits that this boy was sodomized previously. And he also changes quite a bit of the text. Wortham, though, seemed to have genuine affection for the young people he treated in his clinics, but he also seemed unable to trust them completely. That he changed children's words and altered their meanings in numerous instances as he built up his case against comics speaks to that lack of trust. Wortham feared for the worst with comics. The too many children, their lives made precarious by poverty and abuse, would understand comics only in the same way as he did. For Wortham, comics themselves were entirely suspect, without redemption, without merit. He wanted to protect children and teens from his experience of comics. He didn't trust them as readers to choose the text that engaged them, to take from comics whatever they needed right then and leave the rest. That said, my view of Wortham is admittedly a moderate one. One young reader, Abe Hoffman, that's him circled in the group photo, who loved EC Comics and had a garage filled with them, spoke out at an LA City Council meeting in the mid-1950s when he learned about a potential ban on comics in that community. After I interviewed him last year for a research project, I sent him a copy of my paper on Wortham and a link to the New York Times story, and he wrote back. He said, quote, "I still think that you and other critics were going too easy on Wortham. Hitler was nice to dogs, but that didn't make him a nice person," end quote. I should say that Abe is a retired history professor, but he still holds a grudge after 60 years. So despite the distance of that 60 years and documentary evidence of his wrongheadedness, we're still living with Wortham's legacy. The Comics Code is dead, libraries collect comics, comics are taught in schools and universities, we encourage kids and adults to read comics. We've got great people creating amazing comics for readers of all ages. We recognize comics with awards. We have enormous parties for comics, just like this one. But part of my work is to help us recover and remember these stories about comic censorship and young readers. Mark Twain may have possibly said, "History seldom repeats itself, but it sometimes rhymes." And we have to be on the lookout for the rhymes, such as the ones that Charles mentioned at the beginning. Comic censorship and less overt attempts to control access to comics is not a thing of the past. In Illinois, where I live, in the past year, there was an enormous uproar about Persepolis. I've heard school librarians in Illinois question whether they could purchase books for their collections, like Raina Telgemeier's Drama, because of its references to homosexuality, and Ed Pisker's WYSIWYG, because it addresses hacking. In the very community where I live, public librarians have purchased books like Alan Moore and Melinda Gabby's Lost Girls, only to have administrators later demand the book's removal. Wortham didn't see himself as a censor. In fact, in letters to horror comics editor Alan Hewitson from the early 1970s, Wortham had this to say. "Things have changed since Seduction of the Innocent. Compared with all the mass media, comic books are now only a minor influence. My main contribution was to point out what happens in mass media was not only a reflection of society, but also an influence on it. I have never suggested, endorsed, nor approved the Comics Code. I merely suggested that the most gory crime comic books should not be directly displayed to children of 13 and under. Censorship is what one agency does to another. The Comics Code was not a censorship body. It was an intra-office business arrangement." The path to censorship is seldom direct. It meanders and weaves, directed at times by individual motives, personal vendettas, imperious morality, just as we've seen in some of the stories I've shared today. Censors, including people like Frederick Wortham, seldom see themselves as censors. But I would say we have to resist. It takes individuals like the children and teens who wrote to Wortham in the Senate in the 1950s to speak out. It takes organizations like the CVLDF. We're all in this together. So to close, I want to share a portion of one final letter. Most of the several dozen young people who wrote to Wortham read only the excerpt from his book that Reader's Digest published. One teen, however, read Seduction of the Innocent in its entirety, and he was able to do that because he asked the librarian in his small Texas town to order a copy for him, and she did. And that teen was Bob Stewart, whose name I hope is familiar to you. Here's a portion of Bob's letter to Wortham. He was 15 when he wrote it. "Dear Dr. Wortham, I finished Seduction of the Innocent today, and there are a few points that I would like to dispute with you. The first is your claim that the comic books have never had critics as all other modern-day literature and art forms have. I'm sending you a copy of Petrusby, which I edit and distribute to the fans of the Entertaining Comics group. Besides Petrusby, there are about three or four other amateur magazines published for the purpose of providing EC with constant criticism. Then, too, these same fans of EC have established an interlaced correspondence system over the United States. You must admit, the teenagers who've banded together to cuss and discuss the literate quality of comic books are more than juvenile delinquents. Your claim that Batman is a homosexual is the most absurd thing in the entire book. The only person that would ever notice anything like that would be someone deliberately looking for pornography. No decent, attractive, successful women in Batman? Are you sure you studied it good? What about Vicki Vale? I would think that environment plays a larger part than you have credited to it. All kids read comics, but only some are delinquents. Comic book artists don't aspire to draw for comics? Doc, there's nothing I want more than to draw for EC. The fact that you are against censorship is enough to make James rejoice, because once comics are outlawed out of existence, it'll only be a short step to the book burnings Bradbury science fictionalizes in Fahrenheit 451. Gotta go now. Quite a few other things on my hands, but a little soap and water will take it off. Sin? Question mark. Surely? Exclamation mark. Bob. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carol. And as Carol says, you know, today we do have rhymes of this period in history. We do have, you know, right now a lot of controversy over manga, which is Japanese comics that are coming over, very popular in the States. And, you know, you see the stories coming again and again that the young people are interested in it. Let's curb it. Let's curb what we're disturbed by. And so it's important to look back on this history. You've done a wonderful job in showing new facets of this, so it's a real privilege. Charlie, do you have anything?
Yeah, I feel like we should put our notebooks away and have a little pop quiz. One thing I wanted to say is we have a really special guest in the audience who is Bill Gaines' daughter, Kathy Gaines, is here. You know, for me, the thing that stood out the most and the thing that stands out the most is 90 to 100 million comics a month, you know, and I think Carol's mapped about a billion comics a year. I mean, that's a staggering number of impressions, and when you talk about Wortham, I think, you know, what you got to look at is the context that this was a Senate subcommittee, and this was government-run. And we look at what's happening right now with the government. Things aren't that much different, you know. Charles mentioned earlier about the way video games are the scapegoat. This whole sort of committee that was done had a premeditated conclusion, and that's what they were trying to prove. Because when you reach that many kids, think about it, if you know that 100 million kids a month are reading your comics, something has to be done. Or at the very least, if the people who are reading them or the people who are sort of, you know, our eyes and ears aren't understanding the nuance of it. They're just looking at, in broad strokes, they're looking at the severed head or whatever. They're going to get the wrong impression. The kids that Carol cites, I think, are actually reading it in a very different way. You know, there are lots of sort of conclusions that you could make, but I think that, you know, they set out for a very clear one. And unfortunately, you know, Bill Gaines was the only publisher who appeared on that committee. And, you know, I've seen the testimony, you could read it, you could see it online, you could read the transcript. He wasn't at his best. He was a brilliant man, and he was used to being the boss, and he was really nervous. He was, as we hear, he was up all night, he took Dexedrine, he was a little bit nervous. His testimony wasn't as good. He wasn't prepared, I think. Here's a man who was in charge of his father's, you know, company. And, you know, from people that I know who work with him, he was the smartest man. You could never win an argument with him. Everybody that worked with him, I think he didn't realize what he was going into, how good these senators and these people who question, you know, people on these panels for a living, how smart and manipulative they were. And he was basically, I don't know if there was he was set up, but I think there was a fix, and again, that premeditated conclusion that they wanted to achieve. But I think it all came from, like, oh, we have to protect kids. you know, it may have come from a good place, but I think, again, comics were a big industry, and they needed to somehow, I'm not agreeing that they needed to, but I think the government felt that they somehow needed to police this and monitor it. So I think in the context of all that, it's really interesting, and I think a lot of the things that Carol shared, you know, shed light on that. I think that, you know, it's an amazing period in our history, and it's really something that is really relevant now. I mean, I'm the editor of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid books that we publish, and, you know, they're middle grade books for 8 to 12 year old readers, and, you know, we've sold 100 million copies of these books, and every once in a while we get a letter from one parent. You know, I think in 7 years we've gotten maybe 6 letters, but, you know, we take them seriously, but there's always that, oh, he's a bad role model or whatever, and that somehow people respond or feel the need to respond, whether it's posted on Amazon or other places, that we need to do something about it and provide a better image for our kids than what's depicted in these books. It's not something that goes away. You know, and again, I think the intentions are probably sometimes, you know, for the best, but I think that a lot of times people have agendas, and again, we're seeing that what's happening in the government right now, it's no different, you know. So, but I think that, you know, a lot of the stuff that Carol said, I thought was really, really revelatory, and I think, you know, it's building on an understanding that we have of this period, but, you know, hopefully we'll shed more and more. I didn't realize that the archives were closed until 2010.
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah.
Why don't we open up to the floor for questions?
I think it's very important to, talking about this, to remember that this was only a small element of a general malaise in this country and a paranoia at the time, that you had the Hayes office, you had HUAC, you had Lenny Bruce, you had enormous amounts of very constrictive people's careers and lives were in. I think that although price freedom is eternal vigilance, that to compare today to the 1950s might be a little naive. I think for one thing we're more educated. Another thing that we have access to more information than we did at the time.
I think the stakes were higher.
The stakes are always high when you're discussing freedom. Right. But I don't believe that today, for instance, you mentioned Landis. Landis, one of the statements he made early on was that you'll never see a black man in baseball while I am commissioner of baseball, and he kept them out until 1948. I don't believe that you can have that in this country today only because we are more educated and have more access.
And yet the books are still
You have to be wary of it. But
you do have instances, though, of moral panic leading to legislation that does affect people in a criminal context. The Comic Book Legal Defense Fund frequently is called upon to provide assistance and aid, sometimes even legal aid and monetary aid going to court, for individuals who are prosecuted over the content of the comics that they read or make or sell. And you can go onto our website and read our history and see how, you know, this story that Carol told today starts with investigating and pressuring the publishers. But in the 1970s and the 1980s, you saw that object of pressure move on to the retailers, where retailers are actually facing criminal charges for distributing or selling obscene material, for selling comics to an adult audience. You see today instances where young people, there's a fellow named Ryan Matheson who courageously stood up to the Canadian government when they tried to lock him up for having anime and manga that they alleged was child pornography. And so, you know, there again, you see a misunderstanding of artistic content being led to wild accusations that the material is somehow not tolerable in a civilized society. And so, while it's true we do not have the same level of mass outcry and mass outrage about content, you do still see instances where the law is written in a way and is enforced in a way that individuals are being prosecuted because of art. And you also see instances where parents are told, you are not, like Charlie was saying with Wimpy Kid, you know, I don't want my kid to read this. No kid should read this. And so, you know, the fund does a lot of work to create education to combat those impulses, either on the legal side
by, you know, creating tools like Melinda edited this great resource on manga to explain that it's not all creepy drawings. It's an art form that has, you know, all of these subtleties and nuances, you know, to educate lawyers that, you know, don't take a case that's about child exploitation and spend the money that should be spent going after the bad guys that are exploiting children to create an obscenity charge about art. So on one hand we do that, and on the other hand we do a lot of work, you know, protecting a parent's right to choose what's right in their home. So these things still happen today. We have a few minutes, so I'd like to take some other questions. Anybody else? Yeah.
I have my students with me here today. I teach a course called the Graphic Novel and Lit, and I want to know, since they're college age students and they can't support the at least monetarily, what can they do every day in their own lives to combat censorship and stereotypes about comics and graphic novels?
So I would say to that, to read comics in public and talk about them and embrace their comics reading. That's the best thing from my perspective.
And spread the word. You have the power. Everybody now has the power with social media and this, the vast resources that we have in personal expression, internet publishing, to take these stories and raise awareness of them. You know, if you're here today and you were affected by something Carol said, if you are, you know, aggravated by something that we're saying about your rights, then share it with your peers. The only way that speech can, you know, really promulgate is for more speech. More speech is always better than less speech. So if you can't afford to donate to the funds, you know, someday you will, and we appreciate that. But for now, you know, spread the word. Use your voice. That's what it's there for.
Where do you teach your class?
Arcadia University at Glenside, VA.
I think that's already a start. The fact that, you know, you're teaching a course in graphic novels, which would be, when we were kids, unheard of.
Yeah.
I think the first course in graphic novels was Michael Uslan taught. And I think now a lot of colleges and universities have it, sometimes the most popular literature course that they have. So, I mean, I just keep, you know, finding the right books and finding books that are worthy of teaching.
Anything on the bans list I teach. Thank you.
On this side? Yes.
I'm just wondering, when you were doing the archival work for and finding out all of these responses, I think we all kind of feel like public responses to these kinds of outcries is sort of like a byproduct of social media and the ability to speak out. I had never heard that there were that many people that wrote back to the Senate subcommittees, and having that kind of legacy of like the fans fighting for it, I think is really important for us to know. So how publicly accessible is that kind of information? Because I think it's such a crucial part of our history.
So the information, the fan letters to the Senate are in the National Archives, and I've got a chapter coming out next year about some of those letters. There was one other researcher who mentioned them in her book, that was Amy Nyberg in the book on the Comics Code, but she actually spends like two paragraphs and says, you know, they mostly say the same things and they're not really that interesting. And I think that's very unfortunate.
Anybody on this side?
When you go, I mean, has there ever been a real study about, like, influence of comics? I mean, it seems like you're saying that what Wertheim did was really not using the scientific method, and there really aren't any studies there. I mean, he mentions in his book other, you know, people that, other researchers who he used. Counter that going through the archives? Is there anything that, any real science behind this kind of influence? Because the difference with video games today is that you do have, you know, researchers who are claiming to be, you know, using, you know, sophisticated modeling techniques to show that it does elevate, you know, a violent response in usually college students who they study. But is there anything like that at all?
No, so the studies that he's referring to tended to be either papers written by other psychiatrists, like Loretta Bender, and there were a handful of psychiatrists who theorized. They were reading surveys, so people would, you know, ask a bunch of kids, do you read comics, and what do you like to read? And that's about it. So those are the studies that he's referring to, and there was no scientific method in what he did.
We have time for one more, it looks like. Yep.
Just one question, and I think this may refer back to the first one. Is there a greater concern now? Because in general, the feeling is there was such this national attack that spread out, whereas you can hear now, paraphrasing an expression, a thousand little cracks, that things are happening on a much more local level, that it's not that national attack, but it's when we live in a social media where 1 million mothers organization in one click send 1 million emails to a publisher saying we don't want this, is it tougher now for what you do, and that it seems like it's coming much more local now, and it's not, maybe not always get the big media attention about, you know, this state's trying to do this, but it's just happening on a much smaller level.
I mean, as a publisher, I don't, you know, I haven't encountered, you know, a million letters on anything like that, but I think, you know, I think what you're saying is true. I mean, you see it, everything happening on a local level, whether it's gerrymandering districts so that, you know, they vote a certain way. I think, you know, there's popular votes and electoral votes. I think that, you know, things are happening on smaller levels, but more intensely, and the ability of social media to affect that change again in small areas. Not everybody's reading those tweets necessarily, but if it's being reported or it's within that sort of, you know, echo chamber that it reverberates in, then I think it does. So I think there's some validity to that, but I think it's just happening on every level.
And it cuts both ways, too. Like, the Persepolis story is very interesting because the Chicago Public Schools issued some kind of memorandum in the middle of the night on a Wednesday saying, you know, pull this book. And that was on Reddit, and somebody said, is this for real? And that's how we learned about it. And then the next day, the students learned about it because it ignited across social media and actually, you know, sat in and said, no, you can't take this book away. So, you know, while there are, you know, a lot of local challenges, and, you know, it occurs because you'll see a news story like A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is a good example. In Kentucky, a librarian was being targeted by local pressure groups as distributing pornography to kids because he had League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the black dossier, in his library, and how dare he get out of our community. So you can see, you know, those kind of negative stories happening, but positive things happen too, where we can use the media to have more speech and to be empowered. But it definitely requires constant vigilance and constant participation as well, because it's a lot easier. I mean, we all use the internet, right? It's a lot easier to complain about something and speak loudly about what you disapprove of than it is to calmly and intelligently speak up for what you do believe. So briefly, Charlie, actually, go ahead.
I just had a quick comment, which is I think that the biggest sort of censorship threat today for comics is the hidden, especially from a library and school setting, where the decisions are made just not to purchase. There's still the notion that's widespread that comics are something less than, that they're inappropriate. And even though those collections are changing and you're seeing more comics in schools and in library collections, there still is a lot of, we just won't spend our money there. So I think that's where you see it.
Just very briefly, because we're going to have to give up the room in a minute. So the infomercial part of this, the fund is a non-for-profit organization. We live and die on your donations. To that end, Charlie has these great books. If you could just describe briefly, Charlie.
Oh, so this is a book by a professor named Jim Trombetta, and it's called The Horror of the Horror, and it's a collection of not just the EC comics, because, you know, they're a very, very small part of it. I think, you know, out of all the hundreds of horror comics that were coming out and crime comics that were coming out in the 50s, you know, one small percentage of it was EC. The rest of it were all these other ones, and, you know, EC was the best of the best. And then there were all these smaller publishers who were getting into the game who didn't have the artists or the writers or the talent that the EC guys did. And some of those are genuinely horrific, even by today's standards. And that's what this book collects. It sort of collects all that with... Jim is a Shakespearean professor, and one of the reasons I hired him, because he wasn't a diehard comics fan. He was really more of a scholar, and he wrote episodes of The Flash, you know, TV show, so he had some comics affiliation. But also in the book, there's a DVD for a thing called Confidential File. It's a half-hour, basically... show that was put out on TV, but it's almost like an infomercial for the Senate subcommittees. The thing is, it came out a year after the committees, and it was already a done deal. Like, comics were, you know, the code was already created this menace was already tamed. So this DVD is sort of like a little propaganda film, and it's really fascinating. It's like Reefer Madness for comics.
It's amazing history. So the first two folks to join at the $50 level will give that to you. You can do it after the panel, find me, or go up to our booth. And we also have these really cool shirts, thanks to Kathy Gaines, that if you, like me, are a fan of EC, you'll want. It says, Bill Gaines was right, and by golly, he was. And so we're going to leave you with that, and thank you so much for your participation.